Article 2 of the Constitution stipulates that the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America. Apart from creating an office of vice president and a vague reference to certain executive departments and their principal officer, the Constitution said nothing more about what should compose the executive branch. So it was not clear what these executive departments should be, or whether they should be filled by people who acted merely as Washington's assistants, or whether they should be ministers of state on the British model, with wide discretion about initiating policy and guiding it through Congress, or whether the Senate as a whole should act as a sort of executive counsel to the president and share authority with him. There was, however, the precedent set under the Articles of Confederation for departments of finance, state affairs, and war. And in fact, the holders of those offices under the Confederation would continue to act in those capacities until something different emerged. Once again, Madison moved to the front of the discussion. On May 19, 1789, New Jersey Representative Elias Boudinot introduced the subject of departments of an executive nature in aid of the president and called for a select committee to establish an office for the management of the finances of the United States and then go on to the consideration of the War Department and the Department of Foreign Affairs. When Boudinot's motion looked like it would be lost in a welter of self-important comments from other representatives, Madison stepped forward to shorten their deliberations and offered a sweeping motion that at once established the three offices and the secretaries to fill them. Elbridge Gerry, remembering the brief tenure of Robert Morris as the chief financial officer under the Confederation, moved to put the oversight of finance under a board of commissioners. And there was a dreary amount of wrangling over whether the president should have the power to dismiss as well as appoint the heads of the departments. Not until June 24th did Madison succeed in getting a yes vote on the Department of Foreign Affairs, followed by another yes vote on the War Department on June 27th, and a Treasury Department with a single finance officer on July 2nd. The Senate then did its own share of wrangling over the departments until August 25th, when John Adams cast a tie-breaking vote in favor of the new Treasury Department. The next question then became, who would Washington appoint to fill these secretaryships? For the War Department, there was not much guesswork. Washington's old artillery chief, Henry Knox, had been the Confederation's Secretary of War, and Washington had no hesitations about appointing Knox to the continuation of his old post. For the new Department of State, Washington would have been just as willing to continue the Confederation's Foreign Affairs Secretary, John Jay, in the new office. But Jay preferred a nomination to become the new Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and instead recommended that Washington invite Thomas Jefferson, who had just returned from his 5-year stint as American minister to France. It was a logical choice. Jefferson had been the American Republic's diplomatic representative to America's most important ally and creditor. But the prickly-tempered Jefferson was less than enthused at the prospect of filling a position plainly vulnerable to the criticism and censures of a public. But Jay assured him that the changes in our government will enable you to employ in that department your talents and information in a manner as useful to the public and honorable to yourself as you have done during your legation in France. And Madison insisted that the appointment was a matter of infinite importance. Jefferson finally bent to Washington's pressure in February 1790. And arrived in New York to meet Washington on March 21st. There had been less hesitation on the part of the man whom Washington had nominated to be the new Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton. Washington signed the bill creating the Treasury Department on September 2, 1789, and nominated Hamilton on September 11th. Hamilton was at work 2 days later. The task confronting Hamilton was, to say the least, daunting. The new Constitution finally gave the national government a dependable source of revenue. But that revenue would probably meet only the government's current operating costs. It was not going to do very much to deal with the vast debts the United States had incurred during and after the Revolution, especially debts to the French government and to the flint-eyed bankers of Amsterdam, then the finance capital of the world. Hamilton was also not going to have much time in which to formulate a response. On September 21st, 1789, the House of Representatives directed him to prepare a report on the credit status of the United States and report the same to this House at its next meeting. The House then adjourned and set the date for its next session in January, giving Hamilton exactly 110 days to gather all the information he needed to present his recommendations. Unhappily, the more Hamilton thumbed through the various loans, notes, IOUs, and unpaid interest which had accumulated in the Confederation's hands, the more and more daunting the prospect became. The overall position broke down generally in this fashion. First, there was foreign debt. The United States owed $10 million in direct loans, approximately half of it to the French government, most of the rest to Dutch bankers, and a smaller sum to the Spanish government. Annual interest on these loans, calculated at between 4 to 5%, plus repayment of principal, amounted to approximately $1 million a year. But already the United States was $1.6 million in arrears on interest payments and $1.4 million on repayment of principal. Second, there was the domestic debt. The domestic debt of the United States was in even worse shape than its foreign debt. The Confederation had financed the war not only by borrowing abroad, but in effect by borrowing at home, by issuing a dismaying variety of bonds, notes, warrants, certificates, and promissory notes for the pay and supply of the Continental Army. Overall, the United States was obligated to repay another $16 million just in principal. Add the interest, which remained unpaid, the total came to a staggering $40 million. And then, of course, there was the state debt. Under the loose reins of the Confederation, individual states had accumulated their own indebtedness, which tacked another $25 million onto the bill. Against this, Hamilton could expect an overall income from federal tariffs and excise taxes of a little over $4.4 million, and most of that would go to fund current operations. And this was all complicated by the fact that the ownership of this indebtedness was itself something of a crazy quilt. Some of the debt to the Dutch bankers was actually issued on guarantees by the French government and might possibly be delayed by letting the French argue with the Dutch. Moreover, the French themselves were in deep trouble, both financially and politically, and that might help promote the argument. Popular uproar over taxation and mismanagement had forced the French king, Louis XVI, to call for the assembling of the Etats Généraux, the rough equivalent of a national convention, which had not met in 175 years. And in the meanwhile, rioting had broken out in the streets of Paris. Other parts of the debt had been issued to contractors, soldiers, and suppliers who, in desperation over non-payment, had sold their debts at pennies on the dollar to speculators who hoped to make a killing if the new national government then redeemed the debts at face value. One particularly egregious example of this was the wife of the vice president, Abigail Adams, who had instructed her business agent to buy up depreciated government debt because 100 pounds in the army certificates, though not so valuable at present, will become so in time. The possibilities for dealing with this situation were not appetizing. The national government might, well, as one option, simply repudiate the debt as a responsibility of the Confederation, which no longer existed. Or at least repudiate the unpaid interest and pay off the principal at whatever the current depreciated market value was. Or they might take the path of discrimination, which is to say, pay interest and principal only on notes and debts still held by the original owners, not by second buyers. Third possibility, pay off the entire national debt by imposing whopping taxes and the sale of public land in the West. Repudiation was the simple solution because it simply wiped the slate clean. It was sort of like bankruptcy. You could make apologies to the people who made American independence possible, though at the same moment you would actually make fools of them, and then start in 1790 from a baseline of zero indebtedness. But it also meant that not another lender in either Europe or America would ever agree to loan the American government a single dollar. That meant for the indefinite future that the American economy would be cash poor. American enterprises would be capital poor. And the whole country would remain what it had been under British rule, an agricultural appendage of Europe. Now, this might satisfy agrarians like Thomas Jefferson, who thought that agriculture was the only morally sacrosanct living to be made. But it also meant that Americans would have to live in the shadow of economic decisions made by foreign countries, and perhaps live in fear of takeover bids by them. Discrimination satisfied the moralizers who didn't mind paying off what they deemed to be honest debts, but who condemned rewarding speculators and sharpers. The problem was that not everyone who had bought up discounted government securities and notes was a speculator. The shopkeeper who had agreed to accept discounted Continental Army pay certificates in payment from destitute soldiers was not exactly a speculator. So discrimination threatened many a small merchant who had actually been playing Good Samaritan. As Hamilton explained to Washington, Congress must either erect itself into a court of justice and determine each case upon its own merits, after a full hearing of the allegations and proofs of the parties, or it must proceed upon vague suggestions, loose reports, or at best upon partial and problematical testimony, to condemn in the gross and in the dark the fairest and most unexceptionable claims, as well as those which may happen to be fraudulent and exceptionable. Does Congress have the time to make that kind of determination? Paying off the debt entirely also had the appeal of being simple. But no one in the new government could forget that the kind of taxes necessary to pay off that debt were precisely what had sparked Shay's rebellion. And any expectation that the sale of Western land would bring in sufficient cash to pay off the debt collided with the need to clear those lands of the Indian tribes who occupied them. And those tribes were not likely to go along quietly. And none of these solutions did anything toward extinguishing the state debts. So long as those state debts remained outstanding, foreign investors were still going to pull shy of pouring investment capital into American pockets. Nevertheless, for all the complexities involved, Hamilton was ready, once Congress reassembled for its second session on January 4, 1790, with a report relative to a provision for the support of public credit. What he proposed in the report was to look at the debt not as a problem, but as an asset. Borrowing, after all, is what makes possible trade, agriculture, and manufactures. And, he added, it's what promotes labor, industry, and arts of every kind. Rather than treat the debt as an illness to be cured, treat it as a plant to be cultivated by being well-funded. Repudiation and discrimination would all have the result of scaring off further investment. Instead, let the federal government pledge, through its tax revenues, to fund the debt on a gradual but dependable schedule, with regular interest payments coming from specifically dedicated tax resources. Moreover, Hamilton recommended, let the United States government take over or assume the indebtedness of the states as a measure of sound policy and substantial justice. And, he might have added, to keep the states from rocking the nation's fiscal boat with credit policies of their own. Of course, funding the debt would require new revenue, even if it was not in the quantities that a complete paydown would require. And Hamilton proposed to find that new revenue in Western land sales and taxes on luxuries, such as wines and spirits, including those distilled within the United States, and upon all stills employed in distilling spirits from materials of the growth or production of the United States. To manage the funding of the debt, Hamilton also proposed the medium of a national bank, for which, with the permission of the House, he will submit a plan in the course of the session. The fury which Hamilton's report let loose exceeded all but the most acrimonious debates in the Constitutional Convention. James Jackson of Georgia was on his feet to denounce any measure that made no discrimination between speculators and the original holders of warrants, bonds, or promissory notes. Look at the gallant veteran, raged Jackson. See him deprived of those limbs which he sacrificed in your service, and behold his virtuous and tender wife sustaining him and his children in a wilderness, lonely, exposed to the arms of savages, where he and his family have been driven by this useful class of citizens, these speculators who have drained from him the pittance which a grateful country had afforded him in reward for his bravery and toils and a long catalogue of merits. Nor is their insatiable avarice yet satisfied while there remains a single class of citizens who retain the evidence of their demands upon the public. The state debts are to become an object for them to prey upon until other citizens are driven into scenes of equal distress. Is it not the duty of the House to check this spirit of devastation? It most assuredly is. Adonis Burke of South Carolina also objected to the excise tax on distilled spirits, on whiskey, as universally odious to farmers in the backcountry who converted grain into whiskey to trade for hard coin. But Fisher Ames just as vigorously defended Hamilton's report. The science of finance is new in America, Ames said. And perhaps the report's critics don't understand quite what they are asking for. What, let me inquire, will be the pernicious consequences of not funding the debt, as Hamilton recommended? Will it not be subversive of every principle on which public contracts are founded? No individual would be found willing to trust the government if he supposed the government had the inclination and power, by virtue of a mere major vote, to set aside the terms of the engagement. What was surprising, though, was Madison's contribution to the debate. Madison moved to defuse the issue of discrimination by suggesting that the current owners of notes and warrants be issued new ones based on the highest price the original securities had fetched on the open market. This was not Madison's brightest moment. The truth is that any effort to re-rig the price of redeeming these securities would have driven foreign investment out of America in a stampede. And the proposal went down to a large defeat on February 22nd. But it marked an ominous note of division between the one-time partners of the Federalist Papers, a teacup crack, which was only going to widen the more the ghost of Patrick Henry hovered over Madison. The back and forth raged with few intermissions in the House of Representatives until June, when at long last the House passed a funding bill incorporating Hamilton's recommendations. It took another month for the Senate to agree. But the effects of Hamilton's report on public credit were immediate. United States government securities tripled in value now that there was some assurance that they were going to be funded, thus handing Americans $30 million in capitalization which had not existed before. But Hamilton was not through with a generation of political explosions. The next arrived on December 13, 1790, when Hamilton submitted a report to implement his proposal for creating a national bank. Robert Morris had attempted to create a Bank of North America under the Confederation, only to be stymied by the Confederation's inability to provide a stream of funding and the denunciations of the Pennsylvania Assembly. Hamilton might have been tempted, with that example in mind, to handle the funding of the United States debt and the assumption of the state debts purely through the Treasury on a cash-in, cash-out basis. But Hamilton had a bigger object in mind. If the funding report was intended to stabilize the Republic's credit status, the report on a national bank would take that one step further toward the creation of an active economy. Banks, after all, are more than just stowage places for spare cash. Banks are the legal means whereby groups of individuals pool their private wealth and make it available for large-scale entrepreneurs to borrow and create large-scale enterprises. And in the end, they receive large-scale profits in the form of interest or dividends. Banks are, so to speak, the pumping stations of capitalism. Now, banks, of course, are human institutions like any other. They can commit huge mistakes. They can lend out money to people in bursts of irrational enthusiasm and then have nothing to give back to their depositors when the interest and dividends or principal come due. But without the kind of large-scale pooling of capital which banking made possible, no kind of major economic growth could happen in America. Trade and industry, wherever they have been tried, have been indebted to banks for important aid, Hamilton announced. And he reminded Congress that the United States had relied on foreign banks for survival in dangerous and distressing circumstances. What Hamilton now proposed to Congress was the creation of a joint public sector, private sector venture, a Bank of the United States managed by 25 directors in which both the federal government and private investors would pool funds up to $10 million. The federal government would provide one-fifth of the capitalization from its own revenues, and in return would use the bank as its instrument for receipt and disbursement of funds, and use the bank's paper notes as a national paper currency. Thus, Hamilton added, large sums are lent and paid without the intervention of a single piece of coin. The federal government's involvement in the bank would guarantee its soundness for private investors, and the remaining four-fifths of the bank's capitalization, which they contributed, would be available for lending out to entrepreneurs and business to fuel economic development. The profits, which the bank would then earn, would not only enrich the private depositors, but would then also help pay off the remaining federal debt. The proposal for a Bank of the United States was greeted with a new round of derision and hostility. Jackson of Georgia attacked the bank as a plan for an endless labyrinth of perplexities calculated to benefit a small part of the United States, the mercantile interest only. The farmers, the yeomanry, will derive no advantage from it. Worse than that. And here, Jackson raised the old bugaboo from the ratification process about the meaning of what necessary and proper authorized the national government to do. Principal problem, the unconstitutionality of the plan. Once again, Madison parted company with Hamilton. In calling for a discussion of the bank as a constitutional question in the Committee of the Whole, the powers of the federal government do not include, Madison said, a general grant. It is a grant of particular powers only, leaving the general mass in other hands. And among those particular enumerated powers, Madison found no trace of authority to create a Bank of the United States. And with a dismissal that put an end to whatever was left of his friendship with Hamilton, Madison declared that an interpretation that destroys the very characteristic of the government cannot be just. Madison had an important ally outside of Congress, and that was Thomas Jefferson, the king of agrarian loyalists, who believed that banks existed only to enrich swindlers at the expense of the honest and industrious. Jefferson argued, like Madison, that the Constitution had given Congress no authority to create a national bank, and under the provisions of the Bill of Rights, the entire proposal was unconstitutional from the start. But Jefferson was the Secretary of State. And the person whose ear he was filling with these warnings of woe was no one less than George Washington. The bill to incorporate a national bank squeezed through the House of Representatives 39-20, and that was after approval by the Senate. But Jefferson intervened with a lengthy letter at Washington's request, claiming that since all powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution are reserved to the states or to the people, to take a single step beyond the boundaries thus specially drawn around the powers of Congress is to take possession of a boundless field of power, no longer susceptible of any definition. And the incorporation of a bank and the powers assumed by this bill are perfect examples of such constitutional overreach. Therefore, Jefferson concluded, in my opinion, those powers have not been delegated to the United States by the Constitution. But if the Secretary of State had one ear, the Secretary of the Treasury had Washington's other ear. And Hamilton plied Washington with an equal amount of argument to support his position that a national bank was a necessary and proper function of a national government. Every power vested in a government, Hamilton wrote in reply to Jefferson's note, includes, by force of the term, a right to employ all the means requisite and fairly applicable to the attainment of the ends of such power, provided they are not expressly precluded by restrictions and exceptions specified in the Constitution, or not immoral, or not contrary to the essential ends of political society. Hamilton understood Jefferson's larger point that no government has a right to do merely what it pleases. But in this case, there is a natural and obvious relation between the institution of a bank and the objects of several of the enumerated powers of the government. The bank will expedite processing of receipts, collection of taxes, regulation of commerce. To deny the power of the government to add these ingredients to the plan, Hamilton concluded with a flourish, would be to refine away all government, which is just what had prevailed under the Confederation. Hamilton sent his note to Washington on February 23rd, after staying up all night to compose it. Washington studied it for a day, then signed the bill on February 25th. It was a political victory for Alexander Hamilton, but it came at a cost. First, in alienating Madison and Jefferson, and then in opening a fissure in Congress, which Fisher Ames described ominously as a line between the two ends of the continent, North and South. To the northward, we see how necessary it is to defend property, Ames said, a lesson taught abundantly by Shays, and well learned by those who wish to keep the government in force enough to govern. But in the South, a debt-compelling government is no remedy to men who have lands and Negroes, and debts and luxury. But neither trade nor credit nor cash nor the habits of industry or of submission to a rigid execution of law. They have assiduously nursed the embryos of faction, which the adoption of the Constitution did not destroy. And it has done something that none of the founders anticipated, said Ames. This discussion about credit, about finance, about economics and banks, it has made two parties.